It's the trade deadline special. Eagles and Texans pick up new, if imperfect, weapons. Dante Fowler fills a big need for the Rams, and why the Packers and Lions move valuable veterans. Plus, a lot of love for the Panthers, the end of Jameis in Tampa, and previewing Brady versus Rodgers and Saints-Rams. It's all on a very big show of the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Manoids. Let's go ahead and call this the Trade Deadline Special. Every show is special in its own way, but we'll call this one a special officially. We're going to talk the five big trade deadline deals that happened this week, and then we'll talk about some of these headlining games. But I don't know. I think it was the expected amount of movement, though we did have some surprising individual trades, Andy.
It's fun that we're kind of rivaling the Open Floor podcast guys now that we get to talk about player movement like this and have anticipated signing days and trading deadlines. The NFL's become much more of an acquisition league lately, and I don't know, we've looked at it, who was it? Did Andrew Brandt write about it on our site? I don't know exactly why this has happened all of a sudden. The teams are more comfortable trading now than they used to be, but I do think it's more fun.
Yeah, Brandt did write a column. I think a big reason is they pushed it back. There are, you know, there never used to be buyers and sellers this time of year. I think they pushed it back. And I think we also, as I mentioned at the end of the last show, I think there's more of an appetite for tearing down teams and doing the long-term rebuild among the fan bases. And I think that's a bit of a shame, but that's the way it goes now. So teams are doing it.
Well, and we're going to get into some of these trades. I also think not every time that a team trades, they're tearing down the Golden Tate, Clinton Dix. You know, we'll talk about that. In fact, I'll let you just take over and roll us through these. But I agree with you to a certain extent. I know you're not saying every team does it, but I don't think it's as much of a teardown sometimes as it might appear.
That's actually a really good point, and that's why a couple of these deals were so surprising. We talked about the Amari Cooper deal last week. If you want to hear our take on that, you can go back in your feed and find that. But we're talking about the five trades that have happened since the end of Week 8, and we're going to start with Golden Tate. I thought this was the most surprising one because every one of these other deals, there was some smoke. We were hearing some whispers about the guys involved. The Golden Tate one, you know, we were gearing up for him probably leaving Detroit after the season as a free agent, but the Lions are in this thing, and I know a lot of people look at the Lions and say, well, they can't beat the top teams, and you know, they beat the Patriots and they beat the Packers, so granted it's at home, and if they snuck into the playoffs, they had to play on the road. That's a whole other thing, but this team is certainly not in a position where they're saying, well, 2018 is going to be a long shot. Let's look forward.
No, absolutely, they're not in that kind of position. And what's also interesting, they really don't have another slot receiver on the roster. I think their receiving core is deep enough. I love Kenny Golladay. Marvin Jones, to me, is their number two now, and he's a great number two. TJ Jones has not played a lot, but that's going to change. I think they're fine there, but Golden Tate was such a pure slot weapon. Maybe do they view Theo Riddick as that kind of guy now for him? I don't know who will fill the void with Tate. And I agree with you that they're very much in contention. He's still an excellent player. So that was a little bit surprising. But they got a good return for it, didn't they? What, they get a third and a fifth round pick for him?
They did. I think they just got a three in that one.
Okay. So a three for a guy that you don't anticipate re-signing, that's basically a third round pick for eight games of not having him.
Yeah, and I'll get to that in a second. I just want to back it up real quick. I really don't have any information or take on Brandon Powell, but Dave Burkett of the Detroit Free Press, who is the fine beat writer out there, says Brandon Powell is the guy who is being considered internally as the heir apparent to Golden Tate, and they had sort of been building that up. He's a smallish guy out of Florida. He's a 5'8 receiver. He'll play the slot. So that might be, if they like him internally, that might have motivated this as well. As far as the compensation goes, and obviously a big part of this discussion has to be the comp picks, and what are the Lions going to get? Now, this would be a pick they'd be getting in the 2020 draft if they kept Golden Tate and he left this offseason. I think a question is, though, what is Golden Tate going to be worth on the open market as a 30-year-old receiver, but also taking into consideration, and our Kalen Kaler actually wrote about this in this week's college column, it's another bad class of receivers coming out of college this year, coming into the draft. So there aren't a lot of options out there if you want an immediate upgrade at receiver. Golden Tate, even though he's 30, even though he's a bit specialized with what he does, it's kind of like Jarvis Landry last year. You can't really find an upgrade any other way.
No, and let's remember a few years ago, because we and I'm guilty of this too, we talk about Golden Tate as a slot-only wide receiver, but a few years ago, he was an everything receiver. Remember in, it's 2014, his first year with Detroit, I think Calvin Johnson was hurt for part of the year. Calvin Johnson just left, maybe. Whatever it was, I remember Tate, they moved him all over the formation. He had 1,300 yards receiving that year. He doesn't have to play only the slot. And I think that's a pertinent conversation, A, for his free agency next offseason, which we're touching on, but B, and actually more immediately, for what yes. he'll do in Philadelphia. Because Nelson Agholor has to play the slot. He is only a slot guy. And Philly doesn't have other guys at wideout, so I think they view Tate as more of an everything wide receiver who happens to be very good when he is in the slot.
Would you be open to the scenario? And I honestly don't have a strong opinion on this one way or another. Would you be open to the scenario of putting Agholor back outside, which is what he was kind of drafted as and what he obviously struggled as early on in his career, moving him outside and then using Tate as your primary slot guy? Or, I mean, realistically, they could also do a little mix and match with those roles too.
Yeah, and I'm sure they will mix and match. Everybody mixes and matches. You have to if you want to be a diverse offense. I think it's so clear that Agholor is so much better inside. The gap between Agholor as an inside and outside receiver is so much bigger than the gap between Tate as an inside and outside receiver. So I would not mess around with Agholor a whole lot, but I would not be shocked if they do. I mean, maybe they do view it as an opportunity. And really all we're talking about is you have to get the guy clean access off the snap. Agholor, mm-hmm. this is. So you can, and they put him in motion and jet motion. He's kind of their move player, and you can continue to do that, and that's a way to use him. And you can have Tate in the slot, and Agholor still doing some of that stuff. So it just depends. It depends. And the other thing, Gary, is they got Dallas Goedert coming along, and maybe they want to be a two tight end offense. Whatever it is, they've got options now, and they did not have options before. I think there will be a domino effect with having Tate there.
Yeah, and look, overall, this is the second year the Eagles have made a trade deadline deal. Last year was Jay Ajayi. They are down guys this year. I mean, they kind of needed more weapons, and Golden Tate might not be perfect. You might have looked at that team and say, we need a downfield threat to complement what they have. But Mike Wallace is hurt, Mac Collins is out, Ajayi is out, Trey Burton, Torrey Smith, Brett Seelig, LeGarrette Blount, those are all guys they had last year who they no longer have. This makes sense just to add another weapon, even if it's not the perfect fit with what they do. And they certainly are creative enough on the offensive side of the ball that they can potentially get some things going here.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Let's go Demaryius Thomas to Houston here. And there was a rumor that the Texans had asked the Patriots about Philip Dorsett, and for some reason just the OCD in me kind of saw that and said, well, that's just perfect, because now you lost Will Fuller and now you get the poor man's Will Fuller to step in for him. Demaryius Thomas is obviously not stylistically the same thing as Will Fuller here, but again, this is a team that just, they were short on weapons after Fuller went down. They were already thin even with Fuller, so now adding Demaryius Thomas to this offense, you have something else besides DeAndre Hopkins.
Yeah, you do. I'm a big believer in how your receivers fit together, though, and especially with a young QB. And you do want to scheme it for Watson. You don't want to ask him to read everything all the time. You want to kind of define his reads and let him be more of a natural athlete at this point in his career. And he's a great quarterback when you do that. And I think then he becomes a smarter quarterback that way, too. You build on that. Demaryius Thomas is not threatening anybody downfield, not as a vertical weapon like Will Fuller was. So now you basically have two intermediate receivers, Hopkins and Thomas, and one of them's an amazing contested catch artist, and the other one has shaky hands. I don't think, you know, this is a downgraded Texans offense overall. I understand why they made the move, though, and it would have been a worse downgraded offense if they'd done nothing, because they are very thin at wide receiver. To me, this is nothing more than a team saying, we got a window open this year. We're a Super Bowl contender, we believe. Let's go make sure our greatest weakness is no longer our greatest weakness. Let's fill that void.
Let me just put this out there. They've had issues in the red zone, and I think it's sort of connected to that. The way Deshaun Watson was sort of so aggressive running the ball in the red zone, I think that's what was leading to a lot of the in that Dallas game, it directly led to the bruised lung and the whatever he had with the ribs or whatever the specific injury ended up being. And I think it's something they want to get away from because, I mean, look, naturally, you can convince Deshaun Watson to protect himself better between the 20s. When the guy's running near the goal line and can sniff a touchdown, that sort of changes the equation. I think that's where he was getting in some trouble as far as sort of just, essentially protecting himself, which they need him to do a little bit better here. Adding Demaryius Thomas, you now have two big guys in the red zone that they can use. Does it warm your heart at all, the thought of this red zone offense maybe being a little bit improved with Demaryius Thomas now?
Maybe a little, I guess. It'd be interesting to hear how Watson is coached in the red zone to use his legs, too, and how he was coached before that Cowboys game and how he's being coached after. Because I know, like, the Dallas Cowboys themselves with Dak Prescott, he's encouraged to use his legs more in the red zone because the payoff is theoretically greater.
Yep.
So, and that's a side note conversation. I guess Thomas helps a little bit in that sense. We've talked last week about red zone and if it's a finicky kind of stat and what you can do to improve as a red zone offense. Thomas over Will Fuller, I guess you've upgraded some of your red zone concepts.
Well, and look, they can't run the ball in the red zone. They just don't have the offensive line to get any sort of push down there, and I think that was their main issue down there. I think that's one where you could look at it and say, okay, this isn't, you could look at the Falcons last year and say, okay, play to play, they don't have an overall problem with their personnel and what they're able to do in the red zone. They're just play-to-play, not getting it done. I think the Texans had an obvious flaw that they were having difficulty overcoming, especially when it came to the tight red zone. But we'll see.
Yeah.
And Denver is Denver. There are rumors Chris Harris might be available. Some other guys might be movable there, but this is the only deal they end up making. And it makes sense for them. They weren't. They possibly could have renegotiated something with Demaryius Thomas in the offseason, but they were not bringing him back at the what was that number? It was like $17 million or something for next year.
Yeah, for them it was. Yep. Yeah, he had some pricey stuff in his contract structure for them. So I understand it. I get. And John Elway was open about it. He said we want to get Cortland Sutton on the field too.
Yes, that's a really good point. Cortland Sutton is and I think Cortland Sutton is making a bigger impact this year than they anticipated. I know a lot of people when we talked to him, last winter leading up to the draft. Even the teams that liked him kind of admitted, well, he might be a 2 or 3 year project, and he has made an immediate impact there, so he is deserving of a bigger role in Denver. Let's go Dante Fowler here. Dante Fowler to the Rams, which this is a logical fit for the Rams. This was their biggest need. They needed someone on the edge. The Jaguars seem potentially a little bit fed up with what's going on in that locker room. Fowler has not been the best guy in that locker room since arriving there. But let's talk about the Rams. What are they getting in Dante Fowler? I mean, he's a guy who played about a third of the snaps in Jacksonville, but you have the pedigree as a number 3 overall pick a couple years back, and he's a guy who has flashed over the first couple years of his career.
Yeah, this is an easy one, Gary. Team needed speed off the edge. We've said all offseason that's the one thing they don't have, and it could be an issue with some of the way some of their cornerbacks play. And we saw against Green Bay, Marcus Peters did indeed get beat on some double moves in that game downfield. And we got beat a few weeks before that as well in some double moves. So the concern we had about the Rams is if the pass rush can't collapse off the edge and force the offense to play on the defensive schedule, it's not a very good defense on the back end. So the Rams are correcting that. Fowler's just raw speed. I think he's better than what his surface shows and what his stats show, but he has not been nearly as good as everyone hoped, and he doesn't always play up to his talent. So it's a roll of the dice by a team that's obviously going all in, and it has every reason to go all in.
Do you, I mean, he'll stand up more in Wade Phillips' defense. Does that
I don't know
concern
if he will.
You
I
in
think,
any way?
No, because I think he'll just come off the bench on third down, which means then it's a four down defense. So that whole 3-4, 4-3, that gets overblown. I mean, Corey Littleton stands up now on the edge there, and Littleton, I believe, weighs in the 220s as a linebacker.
Yeah.
So that's not a big deal to me, even if he does, but I think he's a third down player only anyway. What'll be interesting is Ndamukong Suh has been their defensive end this year because they're so thin there at that position. Mm-hmm. They kept Michael Brockers on the field. Will they continue to do that and bring Fowler off the other edge? Because they've got needs on both sides. They don't have any defensive edge rushers. Or will they move Suh back inside now that Fowler's here? And I'm eager to see which. Maybe they do both.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know we talked all last winter, and we bring it up all the time when we talk about player movement. You can't get edge rushers; they're just not available. You can draft one high. If you have one, you can spend an exorbitant amount of money to keep him, but they just don't come available on the open market. And Jacksonville told you a little bit what they thought about Dante Fowler when they didn't exercise his fifth year option last offseason, but. It seemed like he had sort of run out of time there in Jacksonville, and now he gets a fresh start out of his home state. Goes off to LA now. This one was surprising. Albert Breer actually wrote about this last Sunday morning, and I was surprised to see the name. But haha, Clinton Dix goes to Washington. He is a guy who had played every snap in the Packers secondary this year, and I understand they were probably not going to retain him. He'll be a free agent after the season, so obviously that's what fueled this, but I don't know. I don't know how to feel about this, Andy. The Packers, I guess, are going to roll with Josh Jones and Jermaine Whitehead. They feel like the corners are what makes that secondary work or not work, and they seem to be happy with the young guys, so... I don't know. This seems like an unnecessary risk, especially since you'd get something of a comp pick. They'll get a 2019 fourth rounder from Washington, but they would have gotten something in 2020, maybe fourth round, maybe fifth round, once Clinton Dix left.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by this too, but you know, with Josh Jackson there now, he's basically been that hybrid linebacker slot. And he does a lot of things for him. He's been hurt. He didn't play last week. But, you know, when he's in the lineup and he's healthy, he's a very versatile safety for him. And Whitehead's versatile and Kentrell Bryce is versatile. And so I would imagine those are the three guys that they view as our movable interior players. And we don't need to be spending big. We're not going to spend big money for Clinton Dix as our predominant center fielder next year anyway. So there's the trade. He's a hard guy to figure out, Clinton Dix, because I thought he'd become the best safety in the league by this point. I love the body. I love the fluid athleticism. He's not overly polished in coverage, and that's what makes him hard to reconcile. Honestly, Gary, I was a little surprised Washington made this move too, because I don't think Clinton Dix is a whole lot better, and he's certainly not very different stylistically than Monte Nicholson, their fourth-round pick a year ago, who's been playing safety next to DJ Swearinger for him.
I think he is, and I guess it depends on your definition of significant as far as the upgrade goes. I think he's an upgrade over Nicholson, and I like the pairing with stylistically with DJ Swearinger there, who I love. I love DJ Swearinger. I'll just say that flat out.
Yeah, he does a lot of things that don't show up on paper. His film is a lot better than his paper, and his paper's not bad. Swearinger's a really good safety.
He's also, he is, boy, he is like the alpha of alphas in that locker room too, is the impression we got when we were reporting that Sua Craven story this offseason. But I like the move for Washington. Now, do they re-sign Clinton Dix? I guess a lot of that will depend on how this works out over the second half of the season. But I like it. I still don't love Washington as a team. I think they're basically what the Bills were a year ago. I think they can make the playoffs, obviously, but I don't think they can beat anyone good. Or I should say they can't beat multiple good teams in January. So I don't know how you feel about what they have now, but this makes them better, I think. I like them.
Remember
them.
Yeah, in Washington, they don't view themselves that way. They don't say, well, we're 5-2, but boy, we're sure lucky to be 5-2. We can't beat teams that have quality players. They think, shoot, we're 5-2. We're a 5-2 team. We're in this thing. So I get it from their side. The safety franchise tag value this year was about $11.3 million. So I figure it's going to be $11.8 million, I would guess, something like that next year. That does feel like a lot for a one-year deal with Clinton Dix, but we'll cry. You know, they don't know that now either. They probably have it planned to make that decision for after the season.
Yeah. All right. And one more Packers deal here. Ty Montgomery, Andy. Did you hear the news on the uniform number? Because obviously we have to talk about that first.
I just saw and I hate it.
What I had heard was he had petitioned the league to. You know the Riddler, Jim Carrey's the Riddler. He wore that suit with the question marks all over it. That's what Ty Montgomery was going to do. It was going to be eights all over his uniform. Just
yeah,
like
I saw you troll me
scattered
on
throughout.
You trolled me on Twitter with that.
he's going to do the Riddler, and he's going to wear the little bowler hat too.
Yeah,
yeah, he's gonna
I guess he's wearing 88 in Baltimore too. I don't understand. We've been over this a bunch. I don't understand for the life of me why he's allowed to do that.
I didn't know what to make of it when you originally got mildly upset by it. It's an irritant for you, I think is how I'd describe it. But I really like the fact that people get so upset at the fact that you are mildly irritated about it. And then it's been like just a circle of I feel like it's good-natured trolling, just sort of going back and forth.
I have enjoyed the Ty Montgomery trolling from the, I guess, what are they, the Montgomery supporter? What do we call the people that are in favor of him getting to wear blatantly the wrong jersey number? We need to label those people.
You know what I call them, Andy? The Crazy Eights.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right.
I just came up with that. That was pretty good for the top of my head.
He's not a difference maker if we're talking football, right? I mean, he's not.
Well,
They're number three running back on both teams.
Let's start with, is he better than Buck Allen? Do you play him over Buck Allen?
No, because they trust Buck Allen a lot with some of the subtleties in their passing game. I think both as a route runner and as a blocker.
I mean, I would assume they would use him in maybe more of a less traditional running back role and more of a chess piece role than maybe he was used in Green Bay. They also might not. I mean, look, like you said, it might just be he'll be depth and he'll maybe steal some snaps from Buck Allen in a couple of weeks. If Buck Allen gets hurt, they have a guy behind him. I don't know.
Yeah, see, exactly. The sentence trails off when you start discussing the options with Ty Montgomery. I don't think it's a moves the meter thing. I think the story here is this 88.
I know you would. All right. That's all right. Or actually, I did want to mention one more thing on Montgomery. We did have a couple people on our staff reach out to various people in the Packers building, staffers, players, whatnot, and the things you read about the fumble and what went down and all that, it is as bad as what you've been reading. Everyone sort of confirmed that, and so he was done in Green Bay. I can say with almost certainty he would have been released if he hadn't been traded, but. That's going to do it. That's going to do it for the trade deadline portion of the show. Let's talk the games now. Let's talk what's going to happen in Week 9. And as promised on the Monday show, we are going to start this off with the Carolina Panthers, who Andy is downright giddy about.
So we've got Rams, Saints, and Patriots, Packers, and we're starting Panthers, Bucks.
We're as promised. We're keeping a promise, Andy. We are starting with Bucks at Panthers. We're going to talk about the other two. We're just going to start with Bucks at Panthers because we shortchanged the Panthers on the Monday show. It's just the way it played out.
Yeah, we did. I think I'm falling in love with the Panthers. Their offense is extremely well-designed. They do more with deception and misdirection and subtle deception. They probably do more than any other team, I would say, and that includes the Rams and the Chiefs. Norv Turner's done a great job there leveraging and using Cam Newton's strengths. Christian McCaffrey has a role figured out. It's a really well-designed offense, and I think it's only going to get better as DJ Moore gets better. He's become a movable piece for them, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. We talk about Andy Reid a lot, especially in our offense. In our office, and the way that he has sort of changed with the times and sort of kept up. And we talk about so much, it's the trickle up effect, and you have these, people like to depict it as these dinosaurs in the NFL, and they're so far behind the curve on all this stuff, but. You see what Andy Reid is doing in Kansas City. Bill O'Brien, to a lesser extent, the way he completely changed on the fly with that Texans offense last year, no matter what you think of what they're doing this year with it. This is another one. Norv Turner. I mean, Norv Turner is how many Panthers fans were excited at the prospect of Norv Turner returning to coordinate their offense after the way it ended in Minnesota, and he was the guy who was best known as being the Cowboys early 90s dynasty guy, and he took a year off, he learned some new tricks, and he's deploying them very creatively with his Panthers offense.
And there were signs in Minnesota that Turner would be a good fit for Carolina. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. Turner's son, Scott Turner, is a quarterbacks coach there, and he had been the QB coach there, being Carolina. And he had been the QB coach there a few years ago as well. I think it was Cam Newton's rookie season. And they had installed a little bit of an RPO play for Newton, and which nobody talked about at the time, but RPOs were around back then too. And Turner, Scott, went to his dad with the RPO concept, said this works really well, and Norv Turner ran that with Teddy Bridgewater in Minnesota. They did RPOs, and I think it was successful enough. But Scott was very impressed with his dad for having the – and this is a son talking about his dad, too. We don't think of our fathers as men who change easily. But Scott was extremely impressed with Norv for having that flexibility and learning and continuing to challenge himself. And so he's been even better with all this new age schematic stuff to favor Newton. And then it goes back to – in this NFL, you still got to have third down and long conversions. And Norv Turner's offense is conducive to how Newton would convert third and long. He's a downfield power thrower. He's not a precision accuracy underneath thrower. And it's a downfield power throwing offense.
And we promised we'd sleep on the Jameis Winston situation and think about it and talk about it on this show. Have you come to a more definitive conclusion with what the Bucs should do going forward?
I think his game against Cincinnati was the worst game I've seen, at least in terms of lows. He's a high and low player. He has every game he has snaps, you say, oh, that's why he's the number one overall pick. And then he has other snaps where you say, that's why he still looks like a rookie. And he had so many highs and lows, and his lows against Cincinnati were so atrocious. I don't think the Bucs had a choice. I think they did have to make the move, at least benching him that day. And the fact that we're still having the conversation leads me to believe this Winston era is probably over. And if he didn't have some of the maturity questions, it'd be a much harder discussion to have. Cause I don't think definitively, I'm not going to say he can't play, but the fact that he's not great off the field, he's not great off the field or on the field. He's a guy with decision-making issues, who's also mechanically inconsistent, so he physically and mentally will have breakdowns every game. That's not our starting quarterback. That's not our franchise QB anyway.
Yeah. No, I agree completely. I think it's time for them to move on. I think Ryan Fitzpatrick sticks around as the bridge guy. I hope they keep Dirk Cutter. I didn't think they keep Dirk Cutter after last year. I was pleasantly surprised. I hope they keep Dirk Cutter. I hope they go with Fitzpatrick as a bridge guy and find in next year's draft A lot of sort of high upside, but sort of long-term projects at quarterback more so than last year, and snag one of those guys, and it's back to square one with the future at quarterback for the Tampa Bay Bucks. But I think they're done with them. I think they have to be done with them at this point. Let's go more optimistic here. Let's go the Sunday night game. We'll start with that one since this is the. I mean, it's such a historically great matchup, and we have plenty of stuff on the MMQB this week. Jenny Vrentis sort of looked back on Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers, and how absurd it is that back in 2001, one guy was backing up the freshly minted $100 million quarterback in New England, and no one thought he was going to amount to a franchise player in the near term. And Aaron Rodgers was literally, I mean, he was unrecruited. He received zero scholarship offers his senior year in high school, and how those two sort of rose up, and some of the guys who were in on them early and maybe didn't see them as all-time greats, but were trying to advocate for them when no one else was. But we're going Patriots-Packers here. Let's start with the Packers, Andy, because, I mean, they were essentially they needed a field goal last week. If Aaron Rodgers got the ball back, if Ty Montgomery doesn't fumble there, Aaron Rodgers just needs to drive for a field goal, and they have defeated the Rams in Los Angeles. Defensively, how do you like them at this point, especially now that they're obviously Clinton Dix just moved on, but they're solidified, I guess, going forward in the defensive backfield?
Yeah, they are. Their corners played very well against the Rams for most of the game. So if that's the case, Green Bay's formula, we talked about this on the Monday morning show, it's fast disguised blitzes, so extra defensive backs on the field, and then corners and man-to-man coverage. Now, the question is, do you do that against Tom Brady, given that New England's offense is so proficient at getting the ball out quickly? Because I think when teams have had their most success against Brady, it's rushing three and dropping eight. Remember at Kansas City, week one last year, it's the best illustration. Houston did this to him as well. Those teams kept Brady's completion rate around 50% just by crowding the middle of the field. So I would consider that as well this week. It'll be interesting to see what Mike Pettin does. And Mike Pettin, the D coordinator for the Packers, remember, he's played Brady every year for several years in his career, played him twice a year with the Jets.
Yeah, I mean, look, and I don't think this is going to shock anyone. You think back, you know, the Jets had that one playoff game where they activated like 1,000 defensive backs and just threw them all out in the field, and they shut down Brady that way. There's also been games, you know, the Steelers in the AFC title game 2 years ago come to mind when the Steelers decided they were going to play coverage, and I mean, they just got carved up like it was nothing. I guess when I think back to teams that have had really good games against Brady, they tend to, like the Broncos used to get into those short areas and sort of clog the throwing lanes to Julian Edelman on those shorter routes and things like that. But I don't know, man. This is a tough challenge for a Packers defense that also just traded one of their safeties.
The Sony Michel thing is a big deal, too. New England will run the ball on. If you go light with all these DBs, New England's a much more of a two-back, smash-mouth offense than we realize. James Devlin's a big part of what they do. And the fact that they can spread out into empty formations out of that, that only encourages them all the more to go to two-back. So if they feel like if Michel can play, then they'll feel like they can go to those two-back sets. If he can't, I don't see them doing the Cordarrelle Patterson experiment 2 weeks in a row. I didn't think Patterson looked overly comfortable at running back, although he did get better as the game went along. But this may just come down to what kind of run plays Brady can check in and out of if the Packers do indeed go with all these defensive backs.
Yeah, Patterson did not look terribly comfortable back there. No disrespect to the Bills, but this Monday night kind of felt like a let's rest up type of game for the Patriots. Like they must
have
known that.
You and I have had this argument for years about the Patriots. So you think do you really think that's how the Patriots approached it?
Yes.
Belichick,
I think when
doesn't
you're going...
even bring his – Belichick will keep Brady in if they've got a 30-point fourth-quarter lead sometimes. He'll play his starters in meaningless games.
We talked about this when they beat the Cardinals with Jimmy Garoppolo in the opener a couple years ago. The point I make with that Buffalo game is they're looking at it saying, if we score 17 points – we will win this game because the Bills will not be able to score on three possessions with what they have with Derek Anderson and with all the shortcomings they have on offense. So the bar was low for the Patriots offense, and they're, you know, Gronk is healthy, Gordon's in the lineup. It was a week to, you know, Sony Michel 50-50. You sit him. You don't need him. He you'd rather have him 100% next week than 50% this week, 60% next week. That's my point on this. I don't think they were trying to lose to the Bills. I just think they were comfortable going into that game slightly shorthanded, taking something of a look forward as far as setting their inactives.
Yeah, that could be. And I wonder if this is because the Patriots are so secretive about this kind of about injury information, especially, or if it's a philosophy within the organization. Doesn't it seem like a lot of times when a guy's out of the lineup for New England, he comes back a week later or 2 weeks later than you would guess? It doesn't seem like guys come back too soon very often. A guy, oh, he's sitting again this week, and he's inactive again this week. I think my sense, and we'll never know this without being inside that organization, but my sense is they do take a patient, long-term view within the season when it comes to injuries and letting guys heal up.
Well, it kind of fits everything they do. I mean, it's a team that treats the season like a process. Every September, I shouldn't say every September, but it feels like every other September, when we're through 4 weeks, there's all the end of the Patriots dynasty pieces coming out because they're sitting at 2-2 or they've just lost to Miami or something like that. And they get better as the year goes on. They prepare themselves for December and January football, and that's when you want to win games. That's when it matters if you get upset in January. But I'm not backing. I'm not backing down. I backed down a little bit on the Cardinals game a couple years ago. I'm not backing out on this. I think if Sony Michel, I'll put it this way, if that was a game they needed, Sony Michel is out there. When you're looking at the Bills and Derek Anderson in our center, they had more than enough without Sony Michel to put up enough points to outscore the Bills. That was not a game in danger.
Look, I'm going to give you I guess we're arguing because you said you're not backing down. So somewhere along here, this turned contentious. I'm going to give you this one only because I think you care a lot more than I do about it.
I do, very much. So thank you for admitting you're wrong about everything.
But now you say it. Say it. Ty Montgomery should not be wearing 88.
No, I agree with it. I guess this is my Ty Montgomery moment. I agree with you on Ty Montgomery. I just don't get I don't think about it. You are technically
so
right on
Ty Montgomery.
It's the
same thing I just did. Yeah, it's the same thing. You give me that one because you don't care about it.
I wouldn't say I don't care about it. I agree with you. I agree. If you're going to have uniform number rules, enforce the uniform number rules.
Yes.
But I would not have thought about it a second time had I not known you and done this podcast with you and interacted
enough
with you in my life. That's where it is for me. Anything else you want to talk about this Patriots Packers game? Whenever I think back to the 2014 matchup, I remember Jordy Nelson beating Jarrell Revis, and that's what ended up being the difference in that game. And everyone kind of said that was the Nelson had pushed off on Jarrell Revis. I personally think receivers should have been allowed to push off on Jarrell Revis when Revis was in his prime because it was just unfair otherwise. But that was a great game in 2014. That absolutely lived up to the hype. So this is going to be a pretty good Sunday night for a second straight week.
I agree. And that 2014 game, it was 26-21 is the final score. Sometimes when you get two really good quarterbacks who run really defined proficient offenses. You get a little bit of a lower scoring offensive shootout because there's so much consistency with moving the chains, and there's so many completions that the clock keeps running, and it kind of leaves for a shorter game. So just something to keep in mind. This might not be the high scoring affair. I don't know what the over under is, and we wait till Friday to do that on these podcasts of the MMQB. But I would take the under on this one, whatever it is.
That is nice synergy on the MMQB gambling podcast every Friday with myself, Scott Gramling, and Jimmy Drana. And my brother makes that point all the time. People always look at over-under and say, oh, two great offenses, I'm taking the over here. Over-under is often decided by if you get long drives, especially long drives that falter in the red zone, whether it's a turnover, or a fourth down stop, or a field goal, or a missed field goal. That's the stuff that turns the over-under. It's not necessarily it's almost like sloppy football leads to higher scoring games. You're going to have turnovers, you're going to have short fields, and a lot of possessions going back and forth. So a little bit of gambling advice if any of you out there want to, make a small fortune with those guaranteed bets right there. Let's go Saints Rams. This is a monster matchup. This is, you know, we were all excited about Rams Packers last week and Saints Vikings. This is win percentage wise. I mean, you have 8-0 versus 6-1 right now. I mean, this is a huge matchup and the 6-1 team hosts. And as the old way of thinking goes, Saints are always better indoors at home than they are anywhere else.
They are. I think this game comes down to, or at least I don't know if they are, but that's the old thinking goes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This game, I think, comes down to what's the answer New Orleans has for Todd Gurley. The more I watch that offense and what Gurley's doing for them in the passing game, and last week against Green Bay, he split out into empty formations and caught the ball a few times. And on some important, his 30-yard touchdown, his 2-point conversion, those came out of those formations. I don't love the Saints linebackers in coverage. I don't know if you play man or zone against them to offset it, but however it is, you're going to get Gurley on a linebacker at some point. Do the Saints consider going with Big Nickel, Vaughn Bell in the game as a third safety with Kurt Coleman rather than rotating him? I think you got to do something special against Todd Gurley. I don't think you can just line up and play your usual stuff.
What happened in the first half last week? Why were the Packers successful against this Rams offense? Because they knocked off around. Can the Saints go sort of blitz happy here and try and replicate that?
In the simplest, what happened in the first half, in the simplest terms, and I don't know. Do you think Jared Goff listens to our podcast? I bet he listens to half of them. I bet we're on his feed and he gets this late into the show.
Not this late in the show, yeah.
I'm going to go see him on Friday, so I don't want to be too critical of him now, but he was not good early on. He was not himself, and he left a number of throws on the field, and it made for an inconsistent offense. At halftime, it was like a light bulb went on for Goff, and to give other credit, his receivers became more polished. There just was not the same cohesiveness. The Rams are very detailed in their route nuances and the timing and the spacing and how they stem and present their routes. And they got sharper at doing that after halftime, and Goff got sharper at reading the field, and all of a sudden it was the Rams' offense again. But they were not themselves early in the game, and Goff was, for whatever reason, he was not a comfortable QB early in that game.
Yeah, and no Cooper Kupp in that game. Obviously, I don't want to call him a security blanket because it seems like Goff is quite comfortable with a lot of those guys, Gurley and Woods and Brandon Cooks. Cooper Kupp, at least the early reports, Sean McVay had said there is a good chance Kupp is back in the lineup for this game, so that might sort of help smooth things out with that offense a little bit. Not that they were terrible. They were just bad for one half of football, and then they won the game anyway. The Saints offense almost got something of a, I don't want to call it a week off against the Vikings, but with all those turnovers, sort of got to the end of that game, and I didn't even realize till the next day, mostly because I won a fantasy matchup because of it, but Drew Brees only threw for 120 yards in that game. They didn't have the ball much because they kept on getting turnovers from Minnesota. But I mean, is Breeze just going to essentially dominate that back end of the Rams defense? You know, can they match up with what the Saints have as far as the weaponry goes?
Well, remember last year these teams played in Los Angeles, and the Rams made the Saints earn just about every yard. That game, the Rams linebackers played really well. Now, Ogletree's not here anymore, so it's not an apples to apples. But the only difference in the game was Alvin Kamara on this side of the ball. Alvin Kamara made some huge plays for the Saints. So it's are the Saints a better offense than the Rams are a defense? Yes, but that doesn't mean that the Saints will just run up and down the field on the Rams. I think they'll have to earn these yards.
All right. Anything else from this game that you want to touch on, Andy?
No, but what was up with the end zone last week in the Rams-Packers game, since we're on the Rams? Did anybody – I'm not on social media during games. Did anyone raise a stink about how it was purple and green because of the USC logo and end zone paint underneath it? The Rams blue and yellow on top of the USC red and yellow?
I was half listening to the broadcast as a game was going on. I haven't looked at the schedule specifically, but that might have been, and I could be wrong on this. That might have been the first time this year that USC has played the night before a Rams home game.
Was it a night game? So that's what I'm wondering about, because we kind of give people an assignment to email us or tweet us every week with these weird little things. I want to know why that end zone thing hasn't happened before, because USC's been sharing that stadium with the Rams for a couple years now, and that's the first time I can recall, maybe I'm overlooking something, the first time I can recall that the colors all got mixed together.
I vaguely remember, was that Tom Brenneman doing the game? Because it wasn't Joe Buck, because he was at the World Series. They played it was a 3:30 kickoff against Arizona State for USC yesterday. Now, obviously that, 24 hours is still not a whole lot of time to properly prepare a field for a professional football game. But I thought I heard the commentator say, like, the crew had done a great job turning around the stadium after yesterday's game. I might have dreamed.
Yeah, well,
they always
say that, by the way. The commentators never say, like, oh, they still got some of the bunting up from the college games. Who are these idiots working the stadium?
Bunting.
You know, the first conversation I ever had with Dirk Cutter, I met him at the Senior Bowl in 2012. this is a non sequitur, I guess, but it relates to field colors. You'll see where this is going.
I can't wait for this. Calm down.
No, in 2012, I met him. He had played Boise State. He'd been their head coach in the late 90s. And in the Humanitarian Bowl one year, Louisville came to town. Chris Redman was the QB, and Boise State was such a program that it was exciting that Chris Redman was coming and playing on our field here in Boise. As people know, that was at the time. The BSU is much bigger now, or at least they were a few years ago. Blue field at Boise. The end zones were green for that game. And I think my assumption was somebody, because it was a bowl game. So they ordered end zones for each team. There was a Louisville end zone and a Boise State end zone. And my guess was somebody just ordered it and forgot to mention, oh, the field is blue, and whatever they ordered had a default green background. Now, that was what I was – my theory. I wanted to know. I asked Cutter very first thing, what happened with the end zone order? And, of course, he didn't know. He didn't remember it was a different color until I had pointed it out. But that kind of thing fascinates me. I like the little details of uniforms and end zones and painting the field and how they – you know, each team, the painted field numbers have a different font. It's usually the team's font on the painted field numbers. That kind of stuff to me is fun.
Yeah, that is fun. And by the way, your buddy Will Brunson actually wrote about this very subject the other day. Apparently, and I'll just read this verbatim from Will's story, because that's what this podcast has come to. This is, quote, "Apparently what happened per the broadcast was the field got soaked on Saturday night and the grounds crew was unable to get all the paint off the field from USC's matchup against Arizona State, a surprising 38-35 loss to Arizona State. As such, their only option on Sunday morning was to just toss a ton of paint on top of the paint already in place in order to get the Rams helmet logo on the field."
There you go. And so then it raises the question, is it better to have a completely ridiculous looking purple and green field like that, or just say, sorry guys, it's a USC field today?
Yeah, I'd be fine if they just left it as a USC field. I don't know, maybe the NFL has a problem with that for branding purposes, for America's game of the week.
Yeah, with the green and purple end zones.
There's your answer, Fishbulb. Will Brinson had it. That's going to be a wrap for this show. We'll, and we apologize very much for not doing the mini mailbag this week. We just wanted to make sure we got to all the trade deadline stuff, as well as what we promised with the Panther stuff. We will be back Monday morning. We will take mailbag questions on next week's deep dive show. For now, thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, who make us sound smart. Thank you, as always, to producer Shelby Royston, as well as all the people at Canes 13 who make this show sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode. We'll call it a very special episode of the MMQB Deep Dive NFL Podcast. Andy and I will be back in your feed first thing Monday morning to break down all the Sunday action. I will be back on Friday joining Jimmy Trina and Scott Gramling on the MMQB Gambling Show. Go one back in your feed. You'll get Jenny Rentis, Connor Orr joining Albert Breer to break down the biggest news from around the league, Hugh Jackson firing, all that stuff. We humbly ask that you subscribe to the MMQB Podcast Network wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We'll see you guys Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.